Welcome to the Engineering Influence podcast presented by the American Council of Engineering Companies. Today we're talking with Matt Fultz, who is the director of Matheson Financial Advisors, where he is responsible for project engagement and client management, as well as financial and valuation modeling and analysis of client firms. Matt recently presented an online class for ACEC, Using Valuation to Improve Your Firm's Prospects, and that's what we're going to dive into today. You can find a link to the on-demand class in the show notes. So thanks for coming on the show, Matt.
And Sherry, thanks for having me.
So for most engineering firms, who are the most common buyers? It would seem to me that it would be their employees.
Well, you know, Jerry, I think if you look at it by the numbers, right, you know, annually, there's somewhere in the neighborhood of maybe 250 to 300 merger and acquisition transactions that occur in the industry. But, you know, that's only a small subset of the, you know, call it maybe 70,000 firms or so that, you know, characterize themselves as engineering firms if you go by the census information. You know, so there's a number of companies that don't transition ownership because they're still in that first generation, or they're sole proprietors and, you know, it's kind of one person who hangs up a shingle in their garage, so to speak. You know, but then there's a lot of other, you know, firms that are interested in transitioning ownership internally. They may be in different phases of that process. Other firms set up their ownership in such a way that they never want to transition internally. They'd prefer to sell it, you know, to an outside buyer, but they're just not ready because they haven't, you know, they haven't built the business to the size and level of value that they're interested in to make that sale successful financially for them.
But to your point that there's a few hundred M&As each year, but 70,000 firms, one would have, just by virtue of averages, would assume that there's several thousand firms that are somehow either going out of business or changing ownership each year.
Yeah.
So what's happening with those firms? How are those firms transitioning their ownership?
So the avenues that firms have available to transition ownership, and this isn't something that we touched on directly in the webinar, but you know, there's only, you know, a handful of options that are available to most firms, right? On the one hand, you can simply do nothing and, you know, stop working when you're ready to retire and liquidate your business and wish your, you know, employees farewell and you know, hopefully they land on their feet. Oftentimes we see companies that kind of embrace this do nothing strategy just by virtue of being so busy in their day to day that they're not thinking strategically 10 to 15 years down the road about how they want to exit their business and planning for that transition to make it as seamless and smooth as possible. You know, so that's on one end, right? You can do nothing and liquidate the business, but with the going concern, right, a company that has value, that has backlog, that's expected to continue operating into the future, why would you liquidate your business if we've already explained, you know, that that's kind of the lowest level of value that you could get for your company? You know, so oftentimes, if you're not going to liquidate your business, you're looking at internal transition, and that could be, you know, a management buyout. So looking at the folks within your company that are good candidates for ownership, they're strong leaders. Yes, they've got kind of the technical expertise and they're, you know, students of the business. So they've learned how to be successful, but they've also got this, you know, kind of innate fire in the belly, this entrepreneurial spirit, you know, and a commitment level that's above and beyond someone who simply wants to show up at 9 and leave at 5. And hopefully they come back the next day, right? You know, now it's a little bit more difficult to tell whether people are logging in and where they are with you know, this pandemic continuing. You know, but it's always the hope that people stay, right? It's a people-based business and we need to have those people in place. If you're not going to sell to management or you want to sell a piece to management, but maybe the management team, the next group of leaders aren't fully committed or capable of affording the entire transition, we see a number of companies that also use employee stock ownership plans, right? And you can use an ESOP, as they're commonly referred to. as you know, kind of a financial buyer side by side with management, you know, so purchasing some percentage but not all of the business. Or there's companies that have put ESOPs in place and the ESOP has accumulated 100% ownership. And there's various reasons why that's attractive, you know, but internal transitions are typically done with management teams stepping up to the plate and committing to make it a successful transition with or without an ESOP.
And you made the point in your talk that there's that internal transition programs have been drying up a little because either management teams aren't willing to step up to the plate or they're not interested. I've heard that that's been attributed to the millennials not wanting to lock themselves in. Is that the case, or could it be? What occurred to me was that maybe firms make it too expensive for people to buy in.
Yeah. You know, it's we like to say that, you know, if we've got a willing seller and we've got a willing buyer, then we should be able to carve a deal. You know, but the fact of the matter is, if you don't have a willing seller or you don't have a willing buyer, it's not going to be a successful transition, regardless of how you structure it. Right. And so I think it's you know, that millennial generation. You know, which I'm a part of, kind of on the front end. You know, we're kind of in the late, you know, 30s, you know, and so now coming up on that, you know, opportunity in many cases to be buyers, you know, but there's a lot of claims on cash flow outside of being able to afford a buy-in, right? Many folks graduated from college and had a couple years of, you know, a good run before the Great Recession hit, or folks that, you know, came out of college in the tail end of the Great Recession, and it wasn't, you know, the best job market, right? They were, you know, spent several years living on their parents' couch trying to, you know, amass some nest egg to kind of launch, you know, and so it's, there's a few different things, you know, structurally that I would say that even though it was over 10 years ago that the Great Recession is kind of had this rippling effect, you know, and one of those things is that, you know, sellers, kind of normal sellers who would have sold during the Great Recession delayed that sale because there was a lot of uncertainty with respect to the business. Valuations were down, right? And so they weren't able, because real estate prices were down, retirement portfolios were down as well. You know, so they needed to maximize the sale price for the businesses. And one, that may be a driving factor behind some of the M&A activity. But two, it pushed out, you know, those retirement timeframes. And the other thing that we saw was there was a number of folks that were kind of the natural buyers for that ownership that were either laid off or left the industry during this time as well, right? And so we've got now this, you know, large number of sellers chasing kind of a finite number of buyers, you know, so that's one aspect of it. The other aspect is, you know, these internal programs, they must be structured in a way that presents an attractive and fair opportunity for not only the sellers, but also the buyers, right? Buyers are savvy, even internally, you know, they're, you know, socking money away from their paycheck and their 401k. And if they're, you know, looking at the returns last year, they're saying, oh my gosh, you know, this is, you know, 401k exploded, right? So why wouldn't I want to continue putting money in the 401k instead of investing in my employer and becoming a business owner? You've got to be able to present that, you know, hey, this is an attractive opportunity relative to, you know, these other investments.
So if I'm a firm owner, and I'm looking to hire people, bring people into the company, of course, I'm going to look at their technical expertise. But does it behoove me to be searching out people whom I think might one day take over my share of the business?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's going to benefit not only from a transition, you know, standpoint and opening up doors with respect to being able to transition, but you know, to the extent that you can find people that, you know, have technical expertise, but you know, really exhibit that, you know, entrepreneurial leadership, right? More so leadership potential. You know, those are the folks that are really difficult to come across and need to be held on to. You know, and it's going to contribute to value, you know, or at least it should contribute to value, you know, almost immediately, but certainly, you know, in any of these potential, you know, exit strategies, whether it be internal or external.
Now, you made that point earlier today, as well as in your talk, that this is a very intentional process. Selling your firm is not something you wake up one morning and decide to do. You know, you've used the time frame like 10 to 15 years ahead of time, grooming the new owners, building value in the firm. It seems to me like that's just good business sense. It's not a transition plan. Is there some crossover, or is there some area I'm not seeing?
No, I mean, it is, but you know, it's you know, we tend to look at things as financial advisors from a dollars and cents perspective. And we also recognize that, you know, the construction cycle, the economic cycle typically, you know, runs every 7 to 10 years. And depending on where you are in that cycle, when you start transitioning, it may create some headwinds or may create some tailwinds, right? So rather than try to squeeze everything into this really compressed timeline and, you know, really consume all of the company's available cash flow and starve kind of the cash needed to support the operations, the preference is to look at this, you know, over a longer period of time and recognize that there's going to be, you know, cyclicality, there's going to be volatility, right? Companies may have, you know, record years on the heels of, you know, one or two large projects, but while they're so busy working on those projects, they're, you know, taking the eye off the focus on marketing. Right, so maybe there's now a couple of years that aren't as you know, successful, and so we want to be able to ensure that the ownership program succeeds, recognizing that performance is not always going to be predictable. So yeah, I mean, I would say it's good business sense, Jerry, but it's really risk management, right? It's ensuring that, you know, whatever companies do internally to transition ownership doesn't take all of the profit of the business out of the company and limit the prospects for the business itself.
Your talk was you focused a lot on valuation and value, and at one point you sort of outlined that there are only a handful of things that drive value. For example, growth rate of gross net service revenue, utilization rate, net labor multiplier. Is it possible to boil that down to say, you know, this is the one or two things that really you should focus on as a firm owner?
Yeah, it's cash flow, right? You know, when you look at real estate, it's location, location, location. When you look at business valuation, it's cash flow, cash flow, cash flow. Right. So as an investor, you know, what's providing your return is the expected cash flows from that investment. And so the valuation, you know, it just fundamentally has to be based on that expected cash flow generating capacity. And so the reason we talk about backlog and revenue and trends and we talk about things like net labor multipliers and utilization, you know, is because they drive profit, they drive cash flow. And so it's, you know, it's in that we build our valuation models just this way so we can, you know, kind of focus in on what these drivers of profitability are. We can assess, you know, how things like a multiplier on a firm-wide basis have trended over time, right? Whether that's, you know, consistent, and consistent is kind of predictable, it's less risky than if it's kind of this sawtooth up and down pattern where it's more difficult to predict. So we benchmark against companies' past performance. We also benchmark against industry peers. And really what we're trying to do is we're trying to identify areas of strength and identify any areas of weakness. Because the other piece of this, yeah, cash flow provides the return, But the valuation is also kind of a risk assessment of the business, right? What degree of predictability is there related to that expected future return? Or the flip side is, what are the risks that this projected cash flow stream doesn't materialize, or it materializes to something less, right? Because if that's the case, now we've overpaid relative to the actual return we're receiving, and that's going to push out the ability to afford that transition.
In what you're just describing, it on one level, this seems to me it's a math problem. You have a formula and you plug it all in and you come up with the value of a firm. But from what you were just talking about, there seems to be, for lack of a better term, an art to it, that there are variables that cannot just be looked up on a table and plugged in. What's the relationship between those two, the numbers and the art? How do they play out?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. So we work with a number of engineering firms, and several of those firms rely on internal formulas to determine their annual stock prices for their internal transition programs. You know, and engineers being engineers, they like things to be formulaic, right? It's simple. It's easy to understand. We can plug in these numbers, and there's a direct link between the numbers we plug in and the output. The concern is that, you know, valuation is a little bit more dynamic than that, right? And so if all we're doing is looking at past performance and plugging it into these, you know, prepackaged formulas, then we've taken the subjectivity out of the equation, right? We're not dynamically capturing things that are changing, you know, from an economic perspective or even from an industry perspective. And also, if we know that fundamentally the value of any investment is the expected future cash flow, then that's not being taken into consideration either. You know, so what we try to do is we try to take into consideration the internal factors affecting the company itself and blend those with the external factors and our experience, you know, of working with 60 to 70 firms annually on their valuations. You know, and that allows us to take, you know, real-time things into consideration. You know, an example of this would be back in late 2017 with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, when the C-Corp tax rate was slashed from 35% to 21%. Well, guess what? You know, if you reduce the amount of taxes the federal government is claiming out of your cash flow, then that enhances the cash flow available for everybody else. If all of a sudden now as an investor, we're getting more of that income stream, shouldn't it be worth more? Right? So that's one area where, you know, changing tax policy, and now, you know, with the Biden administration, there's discussion about it going the other way, right? You know, accountants like to continuously refine the way that things are accounted for, right? So, you know, sometimes there's changes in revenue recognition, sometimes there's changes in other accounting aspects that may impact those numbers that are being input into those formulas, right? These formulas can't, you know, they can't adjust for those real-time, you know, items. And then also, you know, investor sentiment, right? So we know that the, you know, just from looking at the publicly traded companies, that, you know, the multiples that investors are willing to pay for those earnings that translate into value, they're not stable across time, they fluctuate. And so it's that real-time market, you know, pricing that's taken into consideration as well.
Just a final question to close up here. Are there unsellable firms?
Of course.
I guess you mentioned the point of a guy who just has his own, who puts up a shingle outside his garage and runs a sole proprietorship until he's done. But what makes a firm unsellable?
Well, I think you have to think of it, you know, in two different ways. One, you know, internally. right? A firm that is, we talked earlier about, you know, being able to provide a fair return for all owners, right? Those who are selling and those who are buying. So if buyers have concern about affordability, meaning they don't think it's a good deal for them, they're not going to want to participate, right? In some ways that we've seen that happen is just, you know, a misunderstanding of valuation fundamentally, you know? And so there's some pre-canned, you know, rules of thumb out there in the industry. And if those are being applied incorrectly, they can really skew the value. You know, so when a company's value is set at a price that's, you know, so high that the cash flows themselves don't support it, nobody's going to want to buy into that because it's a losing opportunity, you know, and it may put the company out of business. You know, externally, you know, you brought up this idea about, you know, should we be recruiting leadership, right? If these are professional service firms and the people are the largest assets that the company has, then what's a buyer really interested in acquiring? You know, certainly it may be different geographic, you know, locations, having a presence somewhere else, maybe adding services, you know, it may be adding markets, but at the end of the day, it's the people that are doing that work. And it's the depth of leadership that's going to allow that acquisition to be successful. You know, so if a buyer looks at this and says, you know, we're going to have to, you know, install a leadership team, then we're not willing to pay, you know, maybe one, we might not be interested at all, right? Because I've seen a number of firms, a number of, you know, specifically on the private equity side, you know, where they're going to want that, you know, leadership capability in-house. And if it's not there, they're not going to be interested.
So I guess to close on that, it's basically is it's the buyer and the seller agreeing on the value, whatever that value might be.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, and sometimes you've got sellers that have, you know, unrealistic expectations about what their firms are worth.
Which is understandable if they've spent their entire life building it. They think that I could totally see thinking it's worth more than it is.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. There's an emotional attachment to the business.
Right.
You know, and so I would say that that's, you know, even for firms that are not currently, you know, interested in transitioning either internally or externally, but they may be down the road. One thing they could do is use valuation as a planning tool, right? So get an independent assessment of what your company is worth today. And you can do that under a variety of different scenarios. You could say, what's the company worth internally to a management team? What's the company worth internally to an ESOP? What's the company worth externally to private equity or a strategic acquirer? And now we've kind of put some bookends around what the value is. And we can use that valuation assessment, you know, because we're really rolling up our sleeves and digging deep almost at a forensic level, you know, into these companies to figure out, you know, what's making them tick. Well, that risk assessment, now it's highlighted, you know, kind of where all the warts are. Right. So if you're interested in saying, okay, well, I've got a 10 to 15 year retirement time frame, and this is what I'd like to, you know, realize in terms of, you know, the sale price for my business, we can start backing in, you know, what size company does that, you know, need to be? How do we get from where you are today to where you want to be? You know, and I think that's really kind of where the power is in the valuation process.
I think that's a good place to end. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Yeah, Jerry, I appreciate it.
We've been talking with Matt Foltz of Matheson Financial Advisors. He did a podcast for ACEC, which you can read about in the show notes. Thanks a lot. And this has been the Engineering Influence Podcast from ACEC.